This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. What goes around comes around might be a good theme for today's show. The what we're talking about are things like the medicines we take or the soaps and shampoos we use. Those chemicals, plus residues from the pots we cook in and the cleaners we use on floors and counters, all end up in the wastewater that goes down our drains. At that point, for most of us, they disappear, out of sight, out of mind. But researchers like my guest today are finding these household chemicals don't just disappear. They turn up in groundwater, ponds, streams, coastal waters, and yes, drinking water. Amy Costa is the director of the Cape Cod Bay Monitoring Program at the Center for Coastal Studies. Laurel Shader is a research associate with the Harvard School of Public Health, as well as a staff scientist at Silent Spring Institute. And Mark Benatti is senior research scientist at Battelle Memorial Institute and an adjunct assistant professor at Bentley University. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks.
Good morning, Heather.
Laurel, what are contaminants of emerging concern? This is the umbrella title given to all of these chemicals, but is there a definition?
Emerging contaminants are chemicals that are not currently regulated in drinking water, but they do raise concerns because of potential human or ecological health effects. There's really no set list for what's considered an emerging contaminant, but typically people think about pharmaceuticals, hormones, fragrances, detergents, any microbials, and other chemicals that can come from household wastewater or other sources and end up in the environment.
And Mark Benatti, we use this word emerging. What is emerging? Are these chemicals that are appearing in the environment for the first time, or is it that our understanding and concern about the chemicals is emerging?
It's more of the latter. Analytical chemistry methods have improved significantly over the last 30, 40 years, and we're only measuring them since the mid-90s, 2000s, but they've been around as long as we've been drinking coffee or taking medicine.
So in terms of the concern about them, is the concern environmental health? Is it human health?
Well, it's both. In some cases, particularly for endocrine disruption, which is the hormones and other current use pesticides are known or suspected endocrine disruptors. It's environmental health. And certainly a lot of these things are showing up in drinking water, raising questions about human health.
So how long have we been looking at this issue? I mean, it seems actually, if you stop and think about it, pretty logical that if we take medicines and excrete them, if we wash soaps and shampoos down the drain, that they're going to end up in wastewater, and that wastewater ends up out in the environment to some degree. So why is this, a surprise, or why haven't we known about this for longer?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, now we're seeing things, we're measuring them. Where we start to look for things, we find them. And so that's a concern that raises some questions. Additionally, in some sense, it's a PR issue, because if you look at what's regulated in drinking water, a lot of the chemicals have long names that are hard to pronounce, and they have acronyms. And so when you tell someone that there's TCE in your drinking water, they say, oh, is that bad? And you say, yeah, it's a carcinogen. But if you tell someone there is caffeine in your drinking water, or there is birth control pill in your drinking water, they know what that is. They immediately associate some sort of physiological effect with that.
Well, as you were saying a few minutes ago, we were talking before we went on the air, and you said, well, these are chemicals that were designed to elicit a biological response. Does that make them of greater concern?
I don't know. That would be a question more for a toxicologist and somebody who's looking at the health effects of people drinking water. I guess in my mind, sure, if something's designed to elicit an effect, it's more of a concern, but pesticides are designed to do things, and those are, show up or are regulated to some extent. Soaps are designed to have some sort of effect, and they do the same. They show up in drinking water and things like that too. So, I guess so.
Laurel Shader, what's your take on that?
Well, certainly the presence of pharmaceuticals in drinking water does raise concerns. We know that some people, for instance, are very sensitive to antibiotics, where other people aren't. And we know that we don't typically give certain medications to pregnant women or to children, because we know that developing bodies are particularly sensitive. So the presence of pharmaceuticals in drinking water, even though they're at levels many orders of magnitude below a therapeutic dose that you would receive if you were actually taking the medication, does still raise some concerns. I also think that a lot of people just think about pharmaceuticals when they're talking about emerging contaminants, but Mark has mentioned many of the other classes of chemicals that are of concern, for instance, perfluorinated chemicals that are extremely persistent. They're designed to be persistent, and they last at high temperatures, and they're found in many places in the environment and accumulate in people's bodies, are another class of chemicals of concern. So,
and where do those originate? Where do those come from in our households?
There are many products in our homes that contain perfluorinated compounds. Think of products with Scotchgard or Stainmaster or Teflon, any kind of non-proof, stain-resistant, or grease-proof coatings on household products. They also have a number of commercial and industrial applications. For instance, they are found in certain kinds of firefighting foams used to treat grease and oil fires.
Hmm. So there's a lot of different things that we're talking about here. It's not just medicines, it's soaps, it's shampoos, it's, you know, you're talking about nonstick pans or Scotchgard furniture. Laurel, you've headed up a lot of research with the Silent Spring Institute tracing these chemicals, essentially the levels that we find a number of these different household chemicals in wastewater, in groundwater, in ponds around Cape Cod. Give us the big picture. How common are these different chemicals in these different places in the environment, and at what kinds of levels?
So Silent Spring Institute has been studying water quality on the Cape for nearly 20 years, and we have been identifying chemicals that can make their way from septic systems, move through groundwater, and ultimately end up in ponds and coastal waters and drinking water. And the Cape, Cape groundwater is particularly vulnerable because it's a sand and gravel aquifer. The water table is relatively shallow, so there's not a lot of barriers or protection between things that happen at the surface of the ground and the water that ultimately ends up as people's drinking water. And on top of that, we know that 85% of residents have a septic system. So there's potential for wastewater to get into groundwater really throughout the Cape, and then that those chemicals can end up in drinking water. Our work has found that ponds on the Cape and that drinking water on the Cape does contain trace levels of these emerging contaminants. And in many cases, we do think that septic systems are the primary source of these chemicals. We've found things like an antibiotic medication called sulfamethoxazole. We've found a perfluorinated compound, PFAS, which is an old chemical from Scotchgard. We've found actually artificial sweetener to be very common in private wells, and a number of other medications and consumer product chemicals. In general, the levels of these chemicals are at the parts per trillion level. And so these are levels that are maybe a little bit lower than typical drinking water standards. But you know, we are looking at a whole new type of contaminants. And as we learn more about things like endocrine disruption, we learn that sometimes you can see endocrine disruption effects at lower levels that you don't actually see when you study them at higher levels. So so the presence of these chemicals so widely does raise concerns.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking about pharmaceuticals and household chemicals making their way into the environment and also our drinking water and food. My guests are Amy Costa of the Center for Coastal Studies, Mark Bonatti of the Battelle Memorial Institute and Bentley University, and Laurel Shader of Harvard School of Public Health and the Silent Spring Institute. Laurel, I want to go back to this research. I mean, this has been decades of work to put together this picture on Cape Cod. Do you have a sense of how representative the situation on Cape Cod might be of the rest of the country?
When we did our study of public drinking water wells, we tested 20 public wells in 9 water districts on the Cape. And for a couple of the pharmaceuticals that we tested, the levels, the highest level that we found was as high or higher than levels that had been measured in other drinking water sources in the U.S. So I think that on the Cape, there's really the conditions kind of span the range of wastewater impacts that we see in the rest of the country. In some places, drinking water is in very pristine areas. We see basically no emerging contaminants, very low levels of nitrate. But at the upper end, we see levels that are, you know, maybe as high as are found in other parts of the country.
Mark Bonatti, what is your sense in terms of the broader picture? Is this pervasive? And if you looked pretty much in any water district in the country, you would find some of these chemicals?
Yeah, we when I was a postdoc at the Southern Nevada Water Authority, we had a paper looking at 19 utilities throughout the United States, the drinking water of 30 million people. Now, we biased our study for facilities that were downstream of known wastewater discharge. And what we saw was, you know, there was occurrence of many of these chemicals in the source water. Some of them made it through the treatment, and sometimes chemical oxidation is a barrier for what ends up in finished water. In other cases, it's not. So what we found in finished water was these are chemicals that are resistant to chlorine or other things that are used in the drinking water process. And then ultimately, we've tracked some of those chemicals all the way to people's taps. What we found in people's taps is generally consistent with what we're seeing in Laurel's data here on the Cape.
So this is something that basically everybody is dealing with, regardless
sure.
of whether or not you've got a septic system or a wastewater treatment plant or what your wastewater situation is.
Everybody's dealing with it. The only thing I would say that may be different about the Cape scenario is that in the summer, the population swells. So you probably have this large pulse of material coming in the summer, and then the septic water flow slows down in the off season.
Laurel, is there any concrete evidence of human health impacts from this? I mean, these are, as you said, very low levels, but as we've also touched on, these are chemicals designed to elicit a response, in some cases at very low levels. So do we have any concrete data on how concerned we should be?
Yeah, that's really a great question. Sometimes people say, well, there haven't been any studies proving, for instance, that low levels of pharmaceuticals in drinking water can cause human health effects. And that is a true statement, although I would also say that there haven't really been any studies that looked for that kind of an association. So I'd say for pharmaceuticals and some of the other consumer product chemicals, we don't really have direct human evidence one way or the other whether they are causing human health effects. For some other chemicals, for instance, perfluorinated chemicals, there have been human health studies conducted, particularly in areas where these chemicals are produced and the drinking water was known to be contaminated by these chemicals. And in those cases, there has been some evidence of human health effects. Levels higher than might be found on the Cape, but not way, you know, orders of magnitude higher, kind of in closer proximity.
Well, and while we're seeing very low levels of any one compound, we're seeing a lot of different chemicals kind of all mixed together in a big unplanned soup. So how does that affect our ability to understand what the risks might be either to organisms in the environment or to us?
Toxicologists are really good at testing one chemical at a time, but you're right, we're exposed to mixtures of all kinds of chemicals, and we don't really have a good understanding of how these chemicals may interact with each other. Laboratory studies do suggest that certain combinations of chemicals can cause effects in human tissues that are not observed when those studies are done using one chemical at a time. But really the issue of mixtures is uncharted territory, and we're just starting to get a sense of how chemicals may together cause a greater effect.
Why are these, you said in defining contaminants of emerging concern, they are chemicals that are not essentially regulated or monitored, their monitoring is not mandated in wastewater or drinking water. Why is that? Why do we not monitor these chemicals?
So right now there are around 100 contaminants that are regulated in drinking water. The public water supplies are required to test for and you know, take action if there are any exceedances of guidelines. There are so many other chemicals currently used in consumer products and that are ending up in water that there is really kind of a backlog in terms of evaluating health effects. There are chemicals such as some of the perfluorinated chemicals and several hormones that are on EPA's current list of, it's called the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule List. So these are contaminants that are on EPA's radar screen. They want to know more about the levels typically found in drinking water, and you know, if they do find some of these chemicals to be common in drinking water, they would become a higher priority for potential future regulation. But it's a very slow process to create new drinking water standards. I honestly can't remember the last time a new one has been added. So there's definitely a backlog.
Do you think that new standards or new monitoring mandates would be warranted?
I think for some chemicals, as we learn more and more about their potential health effects, that it's important to understand which ones are showing up in people's drinking water. Again, I'll point out the example of perfluorinated chemicals, where you know, states have taken action to write health guidelines, and EPA has some health guideline values, and I think those might be the closest ones to requiring new standards.
I mean, Mark, you've been nodding along over here, and I wonder, is there a difference perhaps between asking for monitoring so that we know what these levels are versus asking for a drinking water standard or limits on these chemicals? Would there be a potential benefit to at least saying we need to test for these on a regular basis?
Yeah, absolutely. Laura brought up the UCMR program, and that's coming to a close next year. And there will be a huge data set for the perfluorinated compounds and for the steroid hormones. And if you take those compounds as indicators of other classes of emerging or contaminants of emerging concern, we may be able to extrapolate what levels of other things that we didn't look for we might find in drinking water. And from that data set, it may be worthwhile to suggest a monitoring program. Unfortunately, these methods are very expensive. You're talking about several hundred dollars to $1,000 per sample. So asking all utilities to monitor for them with the frequency that they monitor for everything else would be prohibitively expensive.
Well, and also technologically challenging, I'm guessing, because you're saying we're just seeing these, that part of the emerging concern is that we're just getting the technologies that can actually detect such low levels. So to ask everyone in every town to try to meet this technological bar seems pretty.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of
tall order.
A lot of the stuff that's currently monitored by that's required is done either at utilities or at small labs in and around utilities. For these classes of compounds, there's only a handful of labs in the country that do them, and they go through very strict. There's a lot of hoops to jump through to get these methods up and running, and it's a lot of investment from the lab. We don't have the analytical capability to require every single utility to monitor with any frequency.
All right. That's Mark Benatti, senior research scientist at Battelle Memorial Institute and adjunct assistant professor of natural and applied sciences at Bentley University. Also with us this morning, Laurel Shader of Harvard School of Public Health and Silent Spring Institute, and Amy Costa, the director of the Cape Cod Bay Monitoring Program at the Center for Coastal Studies. We'd also like to hear from you. If you have questions you'd like answered, or if you're working to reduce your contaminant footprint, tell us how. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also email livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests are Laurel Shader, a research associate with the Harvard School of Public Health and a staff scientist at Silent Spring Institute, Amy Costa, director of the Cape Cod Bay Monitoring Program at the Center for Coastal Studies, and Mark Benatti, senior research scientist at Battelle Memorial Institute and an adjunct assistant professor at Bentley University. We're talking about pharmaceuticals and other household chemicals making their way into the environment and back into our drinking water supply. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have questions or if you're trying to reduce your contaminant footprint, tell us how. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Amy, we've been talking a lot about groundwater and drinking water, but of course, a lot of water we think on the Cape, you know, one of the issues with our septic systems is that wastewater flows through the groundwater and out into our coastal waters. And we see a big issue with nitrogen pollution in a lot of coastal waters. How much do we know about whether these pharmaceuticals and other household chemicals are also making their way into coastal waters?
So the Center for Coastal Studies started looking at this in 2010, based a lot on what Laura was doing at Silent Spring, because once she found it in ponds and in groundwater, common sense will tell you that it will also make its way into our coastal waters. So in 2010, we did a really preliminary study to see if we could detect them. And we did. We detected the ones that we looked for. And since then, we've been building on this work to try to get more at information that will give us data on the fate and persistence of these compounds in our coastal waters.
So where are you looking, and what kinds of chemicals are you looking for?
We are looking for the more hydrophilic compounds, so the compounds that are more water-soluble. So we're not looking at the flame retardants and that branch. We're more looking at the pharmaceuticals and the personal care products. We've looked at them in Cape Cod Bay with funding from the MassBase program, and we've looked at them in Nantucket Sound and the embayments on both the Cape and the islands that drain into the Sound. That study was funded from the Massachusetts Environmental Trust.
And you're finding them?
We are finding them, and everywhere we've looked, we've found at least one.
What kind of levels are we talking about?
Extremely low levels, even lower levels than what Laurel is seeing in her studies. Again, levels on the parts per trillion. Most of what we have looked for, most of them are below detection limits, but then the ones we find are very, very low. Probably lower than, there hasn't been much work on in coastal waters. We were the first to look at these types of contaminants in Massachusetts coastal waters. And compared to the rest of the country, we're probably on the low to average side of things.
And when we say parts per trillion, I mean, what does that mean in some sort of sense that we can wrap our head around?
So, for example, one drug that we have found is called carbamazepine, and that is an anti-seizure drug. A typical dose of that would be 400 milligrams per liter, or a 400 milligram dose. We find that drug in concentrations of 7 nanograms per liter. So to get a dose required medically, you would have to drink 57 million liters of water.
That's a lot of water.
Which is about the equivalent to 23 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Does that essentially mean when we're talking about coastal waters, you're putting these very low levels of contaminants now out into an enormous ocean? Do they just get diluted to a level that maybe we don't need to be worrying about this after all, because they're essentially going to disappear in the volume of the ocean?
Dilution is the solution, is what we hear a lot on the Cape. And that, I guess that's the hope. And that's, we can, yes, you're right, we can only detect them at a certain level. Maybe 20, 30 years from now, we'll be able to detect them at very, you know, even lower levels, and we will be able to detect them in offshore waters. But right now, for us, dilution is working. But I wouldn't say that it's a good idea to continue to use our oceans as our dumping ground.
Yeah, and what I would add is when you any chemical that makes its way into the environment, what you're concerned is that it's going to end up in organisms one way or another. And to end up in an organism, typically you see things that are more hydrophobic. They don't like water, so they stick to fats, and that's how they get accumulated in organisms. Of all these compounds, they're on the more hydrophilic end. When you think about things that we're worried about, contaminants of oil are very, very hydrophobic. They like fats. Polychlorinated biphenyls, these are a legacy contaminant that we see in a lot of sites, very, very, very hydrophobic. The pharmaceuticals as a class of compounds are, and endocrine disrupting compounds, are generally more water soluble. So by design, we're not worried about them, at least physiochemically, as much as we are with other classes of contaminants in the environment. But that doesn't mean that there's not a problem. I would also add that once something is discharged to the environment, let's take the example of Cape Cod in a septic tank, it has to pass through the groundwater. So that means it has to avoid sticking to sediment or being broken down by microbes. If it makes its way into a surface water body, it has to avoid being broken down by light, usually the UV spectrum of sunlight. If all of those criteria are satisfied, it will make its way out into Nantucket Sound. And if it is still still hydrophobic enough to start to accumulate into an organism, that's when we might be concerned. And Amy's got a project ongoing right now to look at some of the bioavailability and even bioaccumulation of these compounds, but we don't have results yet. Is that right?
So you've been looking at whether or not the contaminants are actually showing up in animals in some of these embayments as well, not just in the water.
Right. Again, with funding from additional funding from the Massachusetts Environmental Trust, we took our work a step further and looked not just at the water, at these contaminants in the water, but if they were indeed accumulating in shellfish. And we did find some evidence that there were some of the chemicals that we tested for in the tissues of the shellfish. But I should also make note that we targeted extremely polluted sites for these, nowhere where you would ever harvest or grow shellfish. You shouldn't worry about what you're eating.
So, this has been one of the ideas that's come up time and again with the nutrient pollution issue, is perhaps we can solve some of this with growing shellfish that would, eat the algae that are fed by the nutrients, that's extra food for the oysters, and now we've got extra food for humans. Should we be at all concerned about that model if these animals might also be getting the pharmaceuticals or household chemicals that are coming along with the nutrients in the wastewater?
So this was a very preliminary look. We don't know how long these contaminants persist in the tissue. We don't know whether those shellfish metabolize them and pass them through. We don't know if they're just there because at the moment that we pulled the shellfish out of the water, they happened to be in the water at that time. So bioaccumulation is different from biomagnification. We found it in the tissue, but we don't know whether consuming this tissue passes it up further up the food chain. Mm-hmm. And again, most of the shellfish that are available to us to consume are put into clean waters before they are harvested. So one would assume that the shellfish would purge themselves of these contaminants.
So you're still eating oysters?
I am still eating oysters.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Amy Costa, Mark Benatti, and Laurel Schrader about research on household chemicals that are showing up in the environment and in our drinking water. If you have questions or comments, our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Laurel, you've mentioned perfluorinated compounds a number of times already. You say these are some of the compounds that are coming from StainGuard or non-stick. How do these actually end up in our wastewater and getting out into the environment?
That's actually a really good question, and that's something that we're addressing right now. We do know that these chemicals are in many of our household products, but we don't actually have a lot of information right now about how they may end up in our wastewater. We could certainly think that if we're washing our nonstick pans or if we're washing our clothes that have Gore-Tex, that some trace amount could leach off each time that those items are washed. You could also think about your stain-resistant carpet. If you steam clean that carpet or if fibers get off of your carpet and end up in your dust and then you're mopping your floors, those could be other pathways into wastewater. But that's actually something that hasn't really been well addressed that we'd like to work on right now.
And these are chemicals that you have not, I guess, looked at as much in your previous research on, you've looked at hormones and various other household chemicals, and these didn't get looked at previously?
We did include perfluorinated chemicals in our studies of public and private drinking water wells. In our public well study, we did test for two perfluorinated chemicals, PFOS and PFOA. These are longer-chain perfluorinated compounds that are actually being phased out of products because of concerns about potential health effects and their persistence in the environment. And we did find PFOS to be in about 40% of the wells that we tested. When we conducted our study of private wells, where we tested 20 household wells located throughout the Cape, we were able to test for more of them. We looked for about 16 different perfluorinated compounds, and we found 6 of them showing up in people's drinking water, even in really residential areas. And interestingly, we saw that wells with higher levels of an artificial sweetener called acesulfame tended to have higher concentrations of perfluorinated compounds. So it suggests that septic systems could be the source for these perfluorinated chemicals getting into drinking water. So right now we have a study to measure perfluorinated chemicals in household wastewater that will help us understand whether the levels that we're seeing in people's private wells can be explained by what gets discharged from people's septic systems.
This seems to be such a wide open area. There are so many different chemicals that we use in our daily lives and don't even think about, and every household is different. We now have the techniques to start to see these, but it's a huge amount of data with a lot of unknowns involved at every step. How do you begin to make sense of all of the data that you're seeing and start to draw the connections and even tease out what might be important to look at more and pursue?
So Silent Spring Institute is a breast cancer prevention research organization. We were founded by breast cancer activists who were concerned about relatively high breast cancer incidence on Cape Cod and the islands. So our work is framed in this context of women's health, And many of the chemicals that we look at are endocrine disruptors, specifically estrogen mimics, or chemicals that have been found to cause, say, mammary tumors in animals. So one of the perfluorinated chemicals, PFOA, has been shown to cause mammary tumors in animals and also to alter breast development in ways that could increase sensitivity. You're right, there are so many health effects that are possible and so many different types of chemicals. I guess we look for chemicals that, from animal studies, suggest that they may play a role in people's health, and then to really identify what people are actually being exposed to. And for us, that includes not only looking at water, but also what's in people's products that they buy and what's in their indoor air and dust.
Mark Bonatti, there's most of these chemicals that we've been talking about are chemicals that are legal for their intended use, whether that's a medicine or a cleaner or whatever. But there's also been a couple of studies in recent years where law enforcement even have been able to trace cocaine usage or to find meth labs by looking at wastewater coming through specific different districts, whether it's in a law enforcement setting or otherwise. Are there things that we could be perhaps learning about ourselves by looking at our wastewater, about our behavior, or about what different communities are doing just by looking at our wastewater?
Absolutely. A lot of law enforcement agents, let's take that example, for example. A lot of law enforcement groups have suggested monitoring the sewers to try to track down sources of cocaine or the components that go into manufacturing meth. I don't know that it's been proven, but there is some research that suggests that you can trace kind of elevated concentrations of these things back to individual neighborhoods. I don't know if it's actually led to any arrests or not. So,
but it had... Well, I think the one study that I was reading about was actually in Albany, and they said they found cocaine, and this floored me, in 93% of their wastewater samples that they tested, which was pretty astounding. But that the idea they were looking at was kind of, could we find, as you say, the communities where use seems to be elevated and maybe target our drug enforcement or drug prevention activities to those neighborhoods.
Yeah, and that I think is a viable approach, trying to allocate limited assets to where they're needed most. And certainly the wastewater stream is a good indication of what's going on geographically throughout a region in people's homes. The other interesting thing I would add is a colleague of mine when I was at Southern Nevada Water Authority took, I forget if it was half-hour or hourly samples from the wastewater stream during Super Bowl Sunday. And what he found was that there were, you know, elevated levels of the illicit drugs because people were celebrating. And at halftime, there was a huge spike in the levels. And then things returned as people took their breaks, went to the bathroom, and things like that. So I'm not sure what you could take from that other than you can track with great resolution what people's behavior is, even on the time scale of minutes in some cases. So it is a pretty powerful tool to think about if you take the human health aspect out of it and try to use these compounds as tracers of either activity or of water movement or things like that.
Hmm. And Laurel Shader, you've seen that not on the half-hour time scale resolution, but you know, just different ponds on Cape Cod seem to reflect the demographic differences of communities across Cape Cod.
In our pond study, we did compare three ponds that were in more densely developed areas and three ponds that had very little residential development nearby. And not surprisingly, we saw that ponds in the more densely developed areas tended to have higher levels and more frequent detections of hormones and pharmaceuticals. In our studies of drinking water, we similarly found that wells that have more residential development in their recharge areas, so that's the area of land that feeds into those wells, in areas with more residential development, we tended, again, to see higher levels and more frequent detections of these compounds. Mark mentioned that these types of analyses are very expensive and that it's not really possible to have drinking water suppliers test for these things routinely. But we do think that we can use information about land use and also other wastewater markers such as nitrates that are regularly measured anyways to help us identify the wells that are more likely to contain these types of chemicals. A lot of people in the Cape are thinking right now about nitrate and how that acts as a nutrient in coastal waters and in ponds to cause algae growth. But we've also found that nitrate is a marker for these other chemicals too.
That's Laurel Shader of Silent Spring Institute and Harvard School of Public Health. Also with me this morning, Amy Costa from the Center for Coastal Studies and Mark Bonatti with the Battelle Memorial Institute and Bentley University. I'm Heather Goldstone. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this morning are Mark Bonatti, Amy Costa, and Laurel Shader. We're talking about contaminants of emerging concern, things like medicines and household cleaners that are making their way into the environment. If you have questions or comments, you can reach us toll-free at 866-999-4626 or by email at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Mark Bonatti, we have talked about just how low these levels are and the fact that there's very little concrete evidence to link most of these chemicals to human health impacts. But there's also just a gut reaction of, I flushed it down my toilet. I didn't mean for it to end up back in my drinking water. I don't want it there. How much should that gut reaction, do you think, influence our policy? Do we need to start looking at solutions or more actions to try to limit the levels of these chemicals?
Yeah. So it's a good question. Fortunately, when you talk about treating water, technologies take care of many, many different things. So it would be rare to find a case where you would say, I want to treat the water to get rid of contaminants of emerging concern, where you're not talking about anything else like nutrients or some of the pathogens, some of the other things that are in a waste stream. So in many cases where you're talking about the presence of these things in receiving waters, there are bigger issues going on. The Cape here, for example, the nutrient loading is still the first and foremost issue. It just so happens that when you have wastewater with a lot of nutrients in it, there are also these pharmaceuticals and perfluorinated compounds and other things. The drivers for these things are drivers for remediation or cleanup, again, are often a bigger picture, wastewater as
right.
a whole. And so, yes, when you talk about upgrading, whether it's on the Cape Cod, getting rid of septic tanks or converting to wastewater treatment, a lot of the options available for wastewater treatment will take care of pharmaceuticals and things like that, in addition to many, many other water quality parameters.
I mean, you work with a lot of different stakeholders mm-hmm. through some of your consulting work. Have you seen communities trying to take steps specifically to address the issue of contaminants of emerging concern, or as you say, are in most cases, is that sort of an ancillary effect?
That's a good question. So in a few locations, there have been endpoints that are specific to contaminants of emerging concern. There are a couple of cases in California, in Las Vegas, where I was. Receiving waters had documented cases of endocrine disruption. So the fish that were developing, the female fish developed normally, but the male fish developed these kind of testy ovary hybrid. Basically, their endocrine system was disrupted. And there were other things going on, nutrient loading and pathogens and the stuff that's associated with wastewater discharge. But in those cases, I think the endocrine disruption was the driver. It's not the norm. It occurs in really the most wastewater-impacted environments in very, very arid areas where there's not a lot of freshwater flow to dilute the amount of wastewater that's discharged.
Laurel Shader, you've got a new project that you're starting up working with Falmouth's Eco-Toilet Demonstration Program. Of course, this issue of how best, both cost-effectively and environmentally, do we deal with the wastewater issue on Cape Cod? Could eco-toilets be part of dealing with contaminants of emerging concern as well?
So as you mentioned, Falmouth is doing a study of eco-toilets as a sustainable approach for handling nutrients. We know that most of the nutrients in our wastewater actually come from us, and so putting in household urine diverting or composting toilets offers potential to divert these nutrients from getting into wastewater in the first place, as well as saving water in the long run. We're currently investigating whether these eco-toilets also prevent things like pharmaceuticals and hormones that come from our bodies from getting into wastewater as well. So we are testing people's septic systems before and after they install eco-toilets in their homes and looking at how the levels of these chemicals change. We anticipate that we might see reductions in pharmaceuticals and hormones, but that other chemicals, for instance, from cleaning products and consumer products, will not actually change because they get into our wastewater from our showers or our laundry or down our drain or from our sinks.
What is the status of that project? How far along is it?
So we've tested people's five homes. We've looked at their wastewater before they've installed eco toilets. We've done some sampling after and are waiting for several more homes to put in their eco toilets. So we should have the rest of those results sometime later this year.
And you've also been branching out, working with a social scientist at Northeastern University to study people's attitudes towards these alternative toilets. How does that fit in?
Well, you know, we do a good job of pointing out problems and pointing out things that people should worry about, but we also want to be on the solution side, and we do think that eco toilets can be a solution for diverting some of these contaminants of concern from getting into the environment. And Falmouth's eco toilet demonstration program, to my knowledge, is the first example in the country of a community thinking about putting these in people's homes rather than, say, in an institutional setting as a way to address nutrients. However, there haven't been a lot of people putting these into their homes, even though the town was offering subsidies and trying to encourage people to put them in. And you know, people have hypothesized about what the barriers are. You know, there's economic barriers. These things do cost money to put into their home. And then there's just, you know, people are used to their toilets the way that they are, and there are barriers to changing people's habits. So we're working with a social scientist who has studied adoption of new wastewater technologies in other parts of the world, and she's interested in the Falmouth study as an opportunity for us to learn more about how we can promote these to be used more broadly as a way to save water and divert nutrients from the environment.
Amy Costa, we've talked a little bit about oysters as natural water filters, but wetlands are another major natural water filter, essentially, that we have on Cape Cod. Could wetlands be part of filtering out some of these pharmaceuticals and household chemicals as a way of keeping them out of the environment, I guess?
There was a recent study that did show that wetlands were just as good, if not better, than some of the treatment facilities that we have. So I know on the Cape, we're investigating a lot of these different alternative solutions to dealing with wastewater with nitrogen as our main goal, but it would be even more beneficial if they would, in fact, deal with these other contaminants too.
I mean, is there a drawback to that of trying to use these natural systems to clean up problems? Does that end up coming back to bite us in some different way?
I'm sure it will. There's a drawback. As long as these chemicals are present in the environment, there's going to be a drawback. Whether, you know, wetlands are important from an ecological standpoint. So the effects that putting our contaminants into these ecologically important areas will have on the rest of living creatures is of concern.
Laurel Shader, shy of installing an eco toilet, what are some things that people could do in their homes and in their daily routines to try to reduce how many of these chemicals or the level of these chemicals that we do release into our wastewater?
We do think a lot about actions that people can take in their homes, not only to reduce their chemical footprint out into the environment, but also reduce their own personal exposures and exposures among their family members. So, you know, we recommend reading labels and trying to avoid certain classes of chemicals, things like parabens and phthalates. Avoiding nonstick cookware could avoid certain types of perfluorinated compounds. In terms of cleaning products, we recommend using simpler products, things that your grandmother might have used, like vinegar and baking soda. Just trying to use fewer products and being more aware of the kinds of chemicals that are found in these products.
This is a pretty overwhelming list, though, of chemicals and places that they come from. How do you get over that, I guess, kind of initial overload of thinking these are everywhere and I need to change everything around me? Are there priority places to start? Are there resources people can turn to?
It's something that I think a lot about, especially I have two small children at home, and you know, I feel like I do what I can. I haven't necessarily eliminated everything in my day-to-day life that I'm concerned about. So I think you pick what you feel like you're able to do and what you're able to afford. We have a lot of tips on our website, silentspring.org. You can go to Too Close to Home And there are many tips there for reducing exposures in our day-to-day lives to chemicals of concern. And people can take a look and see which ones they're able to incorporate into their lives.
Mark Bonatti, you also have young children. You've been doing this research. Are there changes that you've made in your home as a result of what you've learned from your research?
Sure. It's, you know, it like Laurel said, it's a matter of educating the consumer. And it is challenging because a lot of these things, it's you have to have a degree in chemistry to understand what they are, what names are and things like that and identify them. But yes, at home, we've gotten rid of certain antimicrobial agents. We try to clean with natural cleaners, vinegar, for example, and things like that. But again, on the other side of it, to get all of these things completely out of our lives, you know, I'd be living in a little wooden hut, not using any sort of electricity or any sort of cookware or anything like that. So it's really, really challenging to prioritize what the important things are to minimize. And maybe it's not one individual class of compounds. Maybe it's just reducing everything as much as possible within reason, because we all do want some level of comfort in our lives.
Laurel Shader, given that everybody is not going to magically eliminate the use of all chemicals in their homes tomorrow, what are some steps people can take if they're uncomfortable with the idea of having these chemicals in their drinking water?
So one thing that we recommend is to learn more about where their water is coming from. So if you're on town water, you can read your town's consumer confidence report to know what contaminants are showing up in water. If you have a private well, you're very much on your own in terms of protecting your water quality. So you should get your well regularly tested. And you can look for things like nitrate, even at nitrate levels far below the drinking water standard. For nitrate, it is a marker for these other types of contaminants. So once you know what's in your water, we do recommend that people consider a drinking water filter, such as a solid carbon block filter that can remove some of these types of emerging contaminants. They also can remove disinfection byproducts. So some water districts do add chlorine or chloramine to disinfect water, but those disinfectants can react with other chemicals that are in the water naturally and produce cancer-causing chemicals. So disinfection byproducts also can be removed by a carbon filter.
Mark Bonatti, we've got about a minute left. You are nodding along here.
Sure, sure. And the other thing I would add, Laurel, is people think that, well, you know, my water has stuff in it. I'm going to move away from that and I'm going to drink bottled water. And I would caution people against that because bottled water is great. It serves its purposes on sports fields and where there's not potable water supplies readily available. But to replace your tap water is still the most tested water source that you can consume. Bottled water does not undergo nearly the testing. And in many cases, bottled water you buy is simply tap water from a different area, bottled, moved across county or state lines, and resold. So you're not necessarily avoiding any of the concern, or not avoiding any of the issues you're trying to avoid by moving to bottled water if you were to go that route.
Laurel, just about a half a minute here. How concerned do you think people should be? I mean, should people be alarmed about this, or is this just, you know, something to keep in the back of your mind?
I think that it's something that people should definitely be aware of. Drinking water is something that we all take for granted, and we expect that our water should be clean. So I think it's important for people to understand, you know, where their water comes from, and also just to really realize that they're part of the water cycle, that our wastewater, you know, goes into the ground, that it becomes part of the water cycle, and that same water is what we drink. So it's important to think about what we do at a household level and to understand where our water is coming from.
Laurel Shader, Amy Costa, Mark Bonatti, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment and the Candida Fund. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd.